experience.
Finally, what remained to be sacrificed? At long last, did one not have to sacrifice for once whatever is comforting, holy, healing, all hope, all faith, in hidden harmony? In future blisses and justices? Didn't one have to sacrifice God himself and cruelty against oneself? Worship the stone, stupidity, gravity, fate, the nothing? To sacrifice God for the nothing, this paradoxical mystery of the final cruelty was reserved for the generation that is now coming up. All of us already know something of this. Friedrich Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil. Welcome once again to an episode of Inner Experience. Today we are talking about one of our favorite topics, the works of Georges Bataille. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe. It only takes $1 to join our Patreon account. You can check out our blogs, find our merch store, and get access to other content. Let's get to the episode. Welcome. This is Your Inner Experience. Today, we have a special episode. Our episode today is on Georges Bataille's essay, Torture, in the book that is the namesake of this podcast, Inner Experience. This is a difficult text insofar as it explores a lot of concepts in Bataille's work. And for that very reason, we are going to begin an analysis of this text by just identifying some of the terminology that Bataille uses. And our goal today is to look at certain parts of the text that explicate that terminology and then develop our own exegetical analysis based on those sections. So, some of the terms in focus today in Bataille's work are these words: impossible, possible, laughter, project, inner experience, torture, divine, extremity, salvation, satisfaction, childishness, Christianity, God, ipse, anguish, and intention. And did I forget any? We have Adam and Will with us today.
Hello.
Hi.
Adam, what did I miss?
Oh, sovereignty, servitude, expenditure, piss, you know, atheology, surrealism.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in here. We thought that one of the possible ideal approaches to dealing with this text was perhaps to give some background on Bataille and where he's coming from with this notion of inner experience. Perhaps one of the ways to do that is maybe go back and listen to our episode on the notion of expenditure, where I believe we explain some of this there. And each one of us in the podcast here today have different experience reading Bataille. So we might be coming from different starting points, but I think it would be worth talking about Bataille's understanding of history, divinity, in religion first. I think I slated myself to go first, but I'm going to give Adam the opportunity to give any introduction he would like, or maybe just some opening comments on what Bataille means by divinity or religion.
Well, I mean, for Bataille, the essence of religiosity is the social and philosophical function of sacrifice. The things are sacrificed to, the ultimate end of something, it's death. This text is really trying to grapple with the idea of an experience which is at its most intense and is not subjugated to any particular kind of discursiveness that would flatten it out, any particular kind of economy of exchange that would maintain the wholeness and unity, which for him is entirely false. And really, this text is itself an act of self-torture because it's trying to convey what he's already defining as unconveyable. And it's about facing oneself, this experience, the limit of language, limit of thought, the limits of knowledge. and seeing what that can point to. You know, what does a system of knowledge and its complexity and its completion, what does that point to as its outside? And what does it mean to experience life not only from the points of knowledge and discursiveness and meaning, but also in the most intense and even torturous mundanities that is the meaninglessness or the aspect of non-knowledge in our own lives?
An important question is, why does Bataille think any of this is important? And from the standpoint of Bataille's understanding of divinity in history, I think one good definition to get a hold of is what he means by divine and how that idea may have been corrupted through the emergence of humanity or man. I will use the gendered term quite a bit here because I think that is one of the things that he's confronting here is the notion of man in modernity as man and with respect to any connotations that term may carry. For Bataille, the notion of the divine in religion is one that has been increasingly corrupted in virtue of man's evolution as a modern or industrial or capitalistic animal. And the coming into being of man involves a radical loss of intimacy with what he calls an immanent flow, a term that's associated with humanity's heritage and animality. Man or humanity has abandoned the immediacy and violence of the animal domain in favor of coming into existence through the creation of tools and the establishment of subject-object relations with the world. With this development of a more and more sophisticated way of reproducing his existence, man instrumentalizes the world and himself. He valorizes reason and all of its attendant virtues, and in doing so, he grows further from his provenance in the animal domain or the immanent flow. The raucous festivals familiar to pre-modern societies, those celebrations in which fellow humans would engage in profound forms of squandering of resources, energy, slaves, and what have you, were attempts to reconnect with the enlivening intimacy of primordial forces. It has been through collective acts of expenditure that the divine could be touched, through bacchanalian parties, grand orgies, ritual killings, annual potlatches, and so on. This brush with the divine was marked by paroxysms of shared joy, laughter, and release. However, the sort of drift that civilization experiences in terms of its historical collective practices of expenditure are complexly motivated, you know, in terms of the development of the means of production and so on. And it's worth noting that the advent of Christianity, and this is something that plays into the essay that we're going to look at here today, as a spiritual technology, allowed man to reconfigure his relation to suffering by elevating the notion of individual salvation above all other forms of inner experience. The coming of capitalism and the industrial age further exacerbate the tendency towards a ever-developing crass utilitarianism, and ultimately constrain the vectors through which this collective expenditure can be achieved. And so for Bataille, he understands the festival as something that becomes captured by the logic of capital. The ritual of squandering excess occurs underneath this grid of intense class delineation. The primary mode of expenditure under capitalism is typified by consumer behavior. Individuals consume excesses as atomized individual or family units. The phenomenon of mass consumption thus mirrors the bourgeoisie's enjoyment of excess and luxuries as they experience it behind closed doors in many cases. Today, perhaps we could say that happens on the other side of the digital mirror. But rather than the festival instigating a radical break with the tendencies that make us all too human, the squandering of excess under capitalism retrenches the logic of productivity to the point of tragically diminishing the possibility of ecstatic release or rendering those possibilities into paltry consumerist rituals. So all that to say that religion and its function has changed throughout history. Hence the notion of the divine has also been transmogrified with the emergence of man as an industrial and post-industrial creature. But as we'll see, the development of reason and its priorities can be escaped through nothing other than reason itself. And the challenge to liberate the intensities which have been smothered by modernity is set within contingent historical coordinates. including its modes of expression and its forms of discourse, which comprise jumping-off points from which a person is able to achieve a limit experience and reach extremity, as he says. So that's my offering in terms of elucidating the background of this text. Now, Will, I know this is one of the first texts that you've read by Bataille. What did you think? What were your first impressions?
This in the brief reading we did almost a year ago now. So I think what struck me is Bataille's methodology here. The writing seems to be as though he's going to attempt, I think, in some ways to present like a Nietzschean critique of a lot of these universals in the history of philosophy, and particularly in, like, let's say, more religious elements of contemporary philosophical engagement, whether that be, you know, Kierkegaard or Christology. But what I found absolutely fascinating was the initial, when I started the reading, it was this initial very, I don't even want to say personal, but there's a level of vulnerability that Bataille is trying to get across, in a sense that this work constitutes kind of the farthest extreme of like a phenomenological inquiry. He's like breaking with the way that like the Sartrean analytic would start, right? Where he goes, I perceive a chair, right? No, like it's far more torturous than that. So I think what hit me was the place that Bataille starts is not actually comparable to what I thought Bataille was going to be up to, which was going to be this sort of semi-anthropological, almost genealogical treatment of warfare as a form of discursivity. Instead, no, he's going to actually start with that which cannot be communicated, and attempt to articulate in a necessarily incomplete way, right? There are all of these use of ellipses, places where he meets a point where he can no longer communicate some sort of central concept, until which he's completely expended himself on it and then just breaks and jumps to a new problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this torture here is him trying to communicate something which, by its own definition, or at least so far as he's defined it, cannot be communicated. And he's trying to get this symbolic economy of meaning to work for him. But at the same time, fundamentally, this economy is so general, it only serves to reproduce itself, that ultimately he can't really fully use it. I mean, if you want to sum up what Bataille is sort of problematizing here, is a kind of latent sort of reformulation of a Christian formula, which is, you know, meaning. You know, man was not made for the sake of meaning. Meaning was made for the sake of man. And in our economies of discourse and utility, such that we are forced into reproducing certain kinds of self-consciousness, certain kinds of meaning in terms of reproduction of values, capital, etc., etc., the economy is sort of parasitizing off of the very laborers who create it. And this is both in the case politically for Bataille, in terms of capitalism, also in terms of the economy of the divine. Of course, economy has its roots in the Greek oikos, which has a strong theological meaning in terms of the distribution of the parts of the persons of the Trinity. And ultimately, yes, this is a theological and economic and a metaphysical question for Bataille, is how to say something by using this system, which ultimately resists it its being used for the sake of, you know, frivolity, for, you know, things that aren't immediately useful to it, and subverting that into a way that also transgresses it at the same time that it also affirms the very capacity of that system to mean anything.
One of the concepts we'll talk about is anguish. Contained within anguish is the impulse to communicate, but it also refers to it's the impossibility of communicating itself. On the other side, we have reason, which has constructed the impasse to the achievement of ecstasy as Bataille sees it in inner experience. Yet it is through reason that we must find their trajectory in this circulating eddy of reason out of reason. So on both sides, on the side of anguish and reason, you have these paradoxes. And so that sort of compounds the problem. We wanted to talk about Bataille's work as a philosophical text, because what we see here is not a straightforward, traditional philosophical exposition, in the sense that any one of us might be asked to write our master's thesis or dissertation, for example. There's a heavily diaristic element to it that we wanted to honor. And so we'll be doing some reading of the text. And like I said, our methodology here going forward is to read small portions that contain some of the concepts that we're talking about and then move forward into a discussion of them. So I'm just going to read right off the top, which are the first two paragraphs on page 39 of the Stuart Kendall edition. And this is what I would consider some of the diaristic element, but also contains the concept of torture and of divine. So hopefully this will start things off for us. Bataille writes, "There is in divine things a transparency so great that one slips to the illuminated depths of laughter, starting from even opaque intentions. I live by tangible experience and not by logical explanation. I have of the divine an experience so mad that one will laugh at me if I speak of it. I enter into a cul-de-sac. There, every possibility is exhausted. The possible slips away, and the impossible reigns. To face the impossible, exorbitant, indubitable, when nothing is possible any longer is in my eyes to have an experience of the divine. It is analogous to torture." So here we have the concept of the divine, possible, impossible, and torture. We could start with any one of these concepts. Adam, where would you like to start? What stands out to you there amongst those concepts?
Possibility and impossibility for me, they stand out the most strikingly because they're the most metaphysical and the most logical. But in terms of thinking about the original part of that second paragraph you was reading out, where it talks about tangible experience versus logical explanation. Well, in that sense, he's trying to counterpose inner experience, mystical experience with reason. And this is quite a typical theological move, you know, mysticism versus rationalism. I think maybe if we could help, it might help to say a little bit about the state of what Bataille thinks reason is and where reason is historically for him. And for him, it is a historical matter because he's coming sort of fresh out of this school of Hegel studies arriving in France in the early 20th century. Particularly the works of Alexandre Kojève, and essentially he more or less buys the idea that reason has perhaps become this completed system of discourse. He believes that the system of German idealism, for a lack of a better term, has been completed in Hegel, and all discursive rationality has been exhausted in terms of what it means to have rational discourse, the pathways upon which identity, difference, concepts can go. And Bataille is terrified at this prospect because he thinks, well, if this has all been done, what is the point of any of us? What is the is man here just to serve this economy of discourse, this ontological, semiotic, and historical economy, which is always stuck in these same loops and has reached its ultimate conclusion? And this is, for him, where are you going after this? He's gone from the merely possible realm, in which possibility means, you know, the object of one of these internal discourses, a historical object, a potential historical, discursive, semiotic, religious object, etc. Although religious, actually not so much, because there's an element of impossibility there. And the impossible side of things is to do with transgressing this logical side of things, because it doesn't fit into the economy, the impossible. It doesn't admit itself of being a possible object that one could speak of, that one could grasp onto in any semiotic or meaningful or economic way. And I think if you're trying to reduce experience to this sort of discursivity, then really you're sapping away a part of the human experience, for lack of a better term, or the human life, which is not entirely subsumed under this mode of rational thinking.
And so for Bataille, the notion of inner experience is that which is not or cannot be subsumed by rationality or discourse. Mm-hmm. So from this point, what we can do is talk about the very first paragraph of part one of inner experience and then move to a section that's in torture and unpack this notion of inner experience. So here are two salient paragraphs. Bataille starts the work by saying, "By inner experience, I understand what one usually calls mystical experience, states of ecstasy, of ravishment, at least of mediated emotion, but I'm thinking less of confessional experience, to which one has to hold oneself hitherto than of a bare experience, free of ties, even of an origin to any confession whatsoever, This is why I don't like the word mystical. He disavows the concept of mystical. What's going on there?
In terms of confessional experience, I mean, you get something back from that. You get absolution, you get something back, you get something meaningful. Mm-hmm. This has no guarantees, this.
When we engage in a moment of confession, first of all, too, there's a whole sense in which we are ethically subordinated to the one to whom we are confessing. That's part of this tableau here. In terms of its value as a religious experience on Bataille's terms, it in some ways is a disavow of the very desire which creates the conditions for the confession too. And this is one of the things that he comes back to in Inner Experience, especially in his critique of salvation, is that that which creates the possibility of salvation is desire itself. But ultimately salvation turns back upon which that it has created. And in essence, it divests us from that constitutive force of desire. Let me continue then on page 51. There's an excellent portion here on inner experience, and then we'll continue the discussion from there. Bataille writes, "I come to this position. Inner experience is the opposite of action, nothing more. Action is entirely dependent upon project. And what is oppressive? Discursive thought is itself engaged in the mode of existence of project. Discursive thought is the fact of a being engaged in action. It takes place in him starting with his projects, on the level of reflection upon projects. The project is not only the mode of existence implicated by action, necessary to action, it is a paradoxical way of being in time. It is putting existence off until later." Now, even just that very short paragraph is really packed tight. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
I mean, like the thing that to me is most fascinating about this concept of action is that it relies on a sort of discursivity. To me, when Bataille uses the notion of dependency upon a project, the project then becomes like the conditions of possibility through which an action can be taken. So the question for me then becomes, how does the limit of these like conditions of possibility necessarily lead to a sort of putting off existence until later? Where does Bataille see, I don't want to use this term, but I'm going to play it anyway, see the possibility of sort of a genuine existence, one that isn't always already delayed through an action mitigated by a project? And maybe then the importance would be like, what is a project? Because when I see the word project, I just think, oh, Schopenhauer, right? Like this notion of like the project towards which like an individual can strive. And that's like a very simple way to put it, but it's not necessarily what Bataille's up to here.
For me, what also comes to mind is the idea of a fundamental project in existentialist terms. Even if our starting point is that the world is inherently meaningless and we are the constructors of its meaning, the notion of project that Bataille is attacking in this essay presupposes the primacy of meaning as that which constructs or establishes a good life over a lively life. In one sense, the purpose of meaning is to stand in the place of life as a lively life, to represent life. And to be sure, it's not the activity of life itself, but that which consummates the activity of life in some sense by standing apart from its event.
Yeah, in a certain sense, doesn't this kind of remind you guys, and I don't mean to just like point at the television like Leonardo DiCaprio here, but like in a certain sense, isn't this kind of comparable to the difference between like Kierkegaard's leap and like Dionysus dancing, right? Mm. Where one ponders and then decides to leap, right? And then decides to commit to a project. Whereas the difference between that and the Dionysian is just like completely unmitigated, undirected, immediate existence.
Yeah.
And to me, it almost seems like there's a fundamental impossibility in even conveying such a thing.
The one analogy that I see is definitely between Kierkegaard's notion of the ethical and of the faith experience in some sense here. But I think the Dionysian is a more apt description or an apt analogy for what it is that Bataille is valorizing, ethically speaking.
I mean, one quote I think is quite good for considering this notion of project. I'm using a different copy to you gentlemen, but of course it says, "Now experience is the opposite of project. I attain experience contrary to the project I had of having it." And there's also, I mean, this has like a logical sense of project is to be avoided or not to be seen as fulfilling itself as project, because every project always goes differently to how we expect it to. The simple idea of our intentions always resolve themselves differently in their expression, in experience. There's a sense in which, and this is quite dangerous if you want to think about this in terms of an economy of meaning that keeps us sort of hooked into it. Because if the identity of the project, both, and I'm going to say it, in itself and for itself, can never fully be matched up, there is always a contradiction between the two. Well, then if your goal is to always have a meaningful project, then you're never going to fulfill that. You're always going to be caught in the same logic. Keep on trying to realize meanings, realize essential meanings, realize the essence of your project in the world. And it's recognizing this fundamental contradiction at the heart of project. That's how, you know, Bataille can say, as he does in the text, the inner experience is the project of getting beyond the realm of project through project, right, by affirming it at its most intense and absurd. And I mean, this he wouldn't have got this sort of reading from Kajev. It's not something that, you know, the Jedi would have taught him. But this is I think there's a very Hegelian bend to this affirmation of contradiction, such that non-knowledge is all that's left after this systemic closure has reduced everything to contradiction at its core.
Yeah, that's actually one of the paragraphs that I think is worth reading out loud. He says, in the Kendall translation, inner experience is driven by discursive reason. Reason alone has the power to undo its work, to throw down what it has built up. Madness has no effect, leaving debris to subsist, deranging the faculty of communication with reason. Perhaps it is before every rupture of inner communication. Natural exaltation or drunkenness has the virtue of a flash in the pan. Without the application of reason, we don't reach dark incandescence. I mean, it leaves to question the how-to anyway. Like, how is it, for example, that reason is capable of doing this? For example, in the work of an artist or a poet, anything that we see on the page, a stanza of poetry, for example, if that was derivative of reaching towards extremity, or achieving some sort of limit experience, the words themselves, of course, don't convey that, at least not in any unadulterated sense. However, the account is in some way representative also of the withdrawal from that experience. Bataille is basically saying here, the way that I'm reading it is, you can't just go around and get drunk and do all those sorts of things. There has to be some sort of engagement with the very forces that suppress our capacity to achieve inner experience. In any case, it's going to require more than a garden variety intoxication in order to arrive at this dark incandescence. So in the end, it's something like an aesthetic engagement that will propel us out of this perpetually circular eddy of reason. But as I said, the derivatives in the form of songs and what have you are not themselves a one-to-one relation with the limit.
I could wager a hypothesis here. It's a slightly more historical one, and if it isn't correct one-to-one, it could still teach us something about what it's trying to do here. So in 1902, you get the book The Varieties of Religious Experience come out, mm-hmm, by William James. So this has been out for a bit. This book's been out for about 20 years, maybe a bit more, by the time Inner Experience comes out. And in that book, he assigns a sort of four main qualities to the religious experience, which are very easy to remember for me because they spell out the word pint. so it's they're all passive. They're all ineffable in the sense they can't be communicated. They all have what he calls a noetic quality, by which I mean they convey a kind of knowledge. And T, because they're all transient, they pass over time. And there's that second one, ineffability, which I think Bataille really could have latched onto, or explained somewhat what Bataille is trying to do here, because under the understanding of religious experience that was very common at this time, very popular, there was this element of non-communicability, one which it can create meaning if you want. I mean, you know, recuperation, yes, of Saint Teresa of Avila or someone like that. You know, there is always a recuperation of certain kinds of religious experience through the canonization of saints. I mean, he talks about St. John of the Cross in this text, but maybe this idea of the ineffable nature of religious experience is what he could see as a kind of a way out. Because religion is a project. It has an economy of meaning, but these mystical experiences sort of have a slight rupture in that. There is a slight rupture in that economy because you can't sell them, really. You can't put them into an economy which they are sold. You can create conditions that engender this kind of escape from all discursivity whatsoever. You can't fully sell it. And maybe you can sort of see this in why he thought the way to go about sort of going forward with a Dionysian conception of humanity would have been through ritual. I mean, this man started a secret society based on ritual. He wrote Meditations on the concept of death, and he tried to reduce it. You know, he was a very sensual kind of guy. But I'm floating this out in terms of how could we understand views of religious experience around at the time to explain how we relate to the idea of project and inner experience.
Yeah, it recalls what I think is one of the most paradigmatic examples of Pint, which is the experience of Abraham taking Isaac to the mountaintop to kill him. And this is something that we covered in our episode on Derrida and the gift of death, which is there is not only an utter ineffability of that experience, but there's an utter incommunicability of that experience as well, without a withdrawal or absencing of the faith experience or of God. What you have, as soon as we open our mouths to speak, we come back into the realm of the discursive, of the ethical. We make our exit from that sort of sensuous engagement with the divine. And Bataille is definitely reacting to Kierkegaard here. I mean, I see it on the page. And then Derrida emerges later to talk about how in ethical terms, that even the ethical decisions that we make, he kind of takes Bataille a step forward here in saying that even the reasons for our ethical choices have this non-discursive dimension to them, which is utterly incommunicable.
In a sense, Bataille is trying to show a sort of I don't even want to say universal, but like he wants to, I'm going to say it, profanate the figure of the warrior of the Knight of Faith to that level of immediacy and experience that cannot be communicated, rather than like the fear of God constituting like both the capacity for initial knowledge and the totality of knowledge itself, right? In fact, the immediacy of experience is already mitigated the moment that communication begins. But what I think is really cool, and maybe I'm like completely off base and unhinged with my like garbage philosophical like sued training, but in a sense, he's sort of flipping the script with Kierkegaard here, but maintaining that level of incommunicability that I think is really interesting.
Maybe the next thing that we'll talk about is salvation. This is probably one of the most important parts of the text. And a few months ago on Twitter, I tweeted out a paragraph from here. It's basically Bataille's huge dunk on Hegel, which Adam will be forced to respond to. But regardless, I think the paragraph that I'm about to read is very provocative of, I mean, I think it really contains in the most salient form Bataille's critique of Hegel. It starts on page 48 at the bottom of the Kendall translation. It says, "A little comic summary. Hegel, I imagine, touched the extremity." So one of the things we'll probably have to talk about a little bit more is the extremity and limit experience. "He was still young and thought he was going mad. I even imagine that he elaborated the system to escape. Each kind of conquest undoubtedly is made by a man fleeing a threat. In the end, Hegel arrives at satisfaction, turns his back on extremity. Supplication is dead in him. When one seeks salvation in any case, one continues to live. One cannot be certain. One must continue to supplicate. While living, Hegel won salvation. killed supplication, mutilated himself. All that remained of him was the handle of a shovel, a modern man. But before mutilating himself, he undoubtedly touched the extremity, new supplication. His memory brought him back to the abyss, to annul it. The system is annulment. Thoughts, Adam?
I mean, honestly, yes. I mean, this is perfectly correct. However, I do think that something could have articulated this a bit better in terms of the absolute limit of the abyss, which, you know, spurned Hegel on to do all of these theories. And that person is me. in terms of, also, I mean, he does, for me, the limit of which Hegel touches upon is the creative nothing, which is both central to, but it's something he has to keep disavowing in so far, is he can never fully understand the radical potentiality of his own thought, especially given doing his own personal reasons where he saw the French Revolution go completely, tits up. And in that sense, Hegel does castrate himself. I mean, especially at the time of the Encyclopedia and the Philosophy of Right, which was notoriously, even the parts that, were censored by the Prussian government, even the parts that weren't, aren't necessarily as radical at the time. And of course, Hegel had a very decent and grounded fear of some forms of radicalism, especially kind of what Marxists would typically call like an idealist kind of radicalism, which tries to impose abstract orders upon the world and usually ends up in the form of a revolutionary terror. I mean, most radicalism that Hegel was thinking of in his time, for example, the Wartburg Festival, which is like a German nationalist festival, incredibly Napoleonic, or actually kind of Jacobin as well, and also very anti-Semitic, so he was always very cautious about radicalism. But overall, in terms of the idea of Hegel himself attained salvation, I mean, in a sense, he did. He essentially died having believed himself to explain all of reality and history up until that point. Had thought he had sort of gotten out of this economy, or gotten the better of this economy of meaning, of reason, by elaborating it to its very limit. And not only reaching this limit, but also running back upon himself to re-elaborate the system, two or three times. I mean, he wrote a system at Jena. The phenomenology of spirit was itself meant to be the first part of a system. And then that never really materialized concretely. I mean, you could count the phenomenology of spirit and the science of logic as one system. But then he produced another system which incorporated all of the previous stuff and then some, which is the encyclopedia. And each one, you sort of see the radicalism kind of petering out each time. But I think he did definitely annul the abyss. I mean, that's the end of the phenomenology of spirit is when spirit itself, in the form of sort of a Christian spirit that sees itself in the light of itself as representing itself as Christ, annuls time. It kills itself simply so that it cannot face the most abstract, most purely negative form of the abyss, which is the time of its own life.
Will, you had a question. Go for it.
Hey, Craig, what does it mean to supplicate? What is supplication in this context here?
Well, supplication is dead to Hegel.
Why is Hegel killed supplication, which is kind of the idea of begging for things? I mean, what do you get the man who has everything? Mm. I mean, if you go through the encyclopedia, Hegel essentially thinks that he's deduced every logical category, every category of nature, every part of human history that he thought was relevant up until then, and how every single school of philosophy interlinks in development up until his own.
Yeah.
I mean, what can you, I mean, if a man is that self-assured of his own system's completeness, and it was kind of complete, but, in the sense in which if you have this completed system, which Kajev has basically been teaching as it shows the end of history and completism of rationality and the system of the understanding of discourses of man and meaning, Hegel mutilated himself. He's mutilated the part of himself which can feel inner experience.
Right.
The part of himself which does not admit of just pure logical explanation for him. He thinks, I mean, Bataille is trying to, in a way, sort of elaborate idea that Hegel misses the particular. He subsumes everything.
And I think one of the ironies is that salvation as a kind of inner experience becomes expressed as a kind of despising of the very desire which constitutes it. I mean, salvation as that which ensures one's redemption cuts us off. It derides and it destitutes the very matrix of desire itself. And Bataille has a nice paragraph about it. This is one of the ones that we marked out that I think we should read here. Bataille says, "Until now, almost every inner experience has depended upon the obsession with salvation. Salvation is the summit of every possible project and peak in matters of project. From the fact itself that salvation is a peak, it is also the negation of projects of momentary interest. At the extremity, the desire for salvation turns into the hatred of all project of the putting off of existence until later, of salvation itself suspected of having a vulgar motive. If I exhaust in anguish distant prospects and intimate depths, I see this. Salvation was only the means of disassociating eroticism, the bacchic consummation of bodies, and nostalgia for existing without delay. A vulgar means undoubtedly, but eroticism." So in some sense, salvation is sufficient in aspiring to achieve inner experience insofar as it recognizes that project as project stands in the way of achieving inner experience, but falls short in virtue of disavowing it as desire, as that constitutive desire, which inner experience is, that which we attempt to approximate or at least, you know, touch or brush, if you will.
It feels like this is just like, in a lot of ways, what I love about this essay is like, precisely because there is like such an exhaustion in the kind of torturous, I don't even want to say internal, but they like these limits do exist internal to Bataille, internal to experience itself. But like there's a lot of mic droppy moments because Bataille's biggest problem is like foreclosure of experience itself, the subjugation of experience to thought, right? He lives by experience, not by logical explanation. How could it get more Nietzschean than that, right? But he finds a way. In a certain sense, if only Deleuze had been more reliant on Bataille's Nietzscheanism when he was trying to make Nietzsche's great enemy Hegel, maybe there would be more going on in those early pages of Nietzsche and philosophy. But like to me, in a certain sense, like there's a desperation and an exhaustedness in this text, precisely because he's dealing with so many different people he's convinced are his enemies, whether it be Kojève's End of History, or on the other side, this particular 19th century form of Christianity.
Yes, but just to add on to that, Hegel is the enemy of Bataille, in the guise of Kojève, only insofar as for Bataille, Hegel is entirely right, and that's a problem. He says, it's, I can't remember, I think it's from Hegel, Death and Sacrifice, or it's one of the Bataille pieces that is quoted by Derrida in his essay From Restricted to General Economy. He says, Hegel did not know to the extent to which he was right. And this was the original, Bataille wrote to Kojève saying, you know, if this is true, what the hell am I to do with the radical negativity that I am? Am I just condemned to be stuck in this discursive system? He was, in a way, looking for an exit after the End of History, and that way he's very relevant to our concerns today. I mean, capitalist realism, I guess, now could be what back then might be called Kojevian realism, maybe.
Hegel but, didn't know that he was entirely right. Hegel did not know he was right. I mean, I see leverage points here for non-knowledge, Adam. What's going on?
Yeah. Well, if you have all of knowledge completed, then non-knowledge is what is pointed to insofar as if you can, you know, have this circle, the self-encapsulation of all knowledge within a system, well, what, as Hegel would very much well know, what does that point to? The non-systemic, the non-knowledgeable.
I think this brings us to the point of contention that I brought up earlier. Like if there is a sort of leverage point, if there is a way in which Bataille has Hegel's number, as it were. I think the issue surrounds the notion of satisfaction versus anguish insofar as that relates to non-knowledge and knowledge. And so at this point, this is the next concept that we'll break into.
Can we maybe draw the lines of distinction between anguish and despair as it exists here? Because I know we're talking a lot about like Derrida's Gift of Death, Kierkegaard, the unbridgeable nature of the finite and the infinite. Like one of my fears is like I found myself falling into defining anguish as just despair in the Kierkegaardian sense, and I want to know maybe a little bit more about what you guys all think anguish is in this text for Bataille.
Okay, that's an easy one. Well, maybe not so easy, but I think it's worth pointing out that the way that he uses anguish is a little bit different from Kierkegaard, also different from Sartre, right? And I'll just read a bit of a paragraph on page 57, where he talks about non-knowledge and anguish, and then that will give us something to go on here. He says, this is in all caps, by the way, for whatever reason, non-knowledge lays bare, period. This proposition is the summit, but should be understood in this way. Lays bare, therefore I see what knowledge was hiding up to there. But if I see, I know. In effect, I know, but what I knew, non-knowledge, again, lays bare. If nonsense is sense, the sense that is nonsense loses itself, becomes nonsense once again, without possible end, right? This never-ending porousness of non-knowledge. If the proposition, non-knowledge lays bare, possesses a meaning, appearing, disappearing immediately, it is that it means to say, and this is in all caps, non-knowledge communicates ecstasy. Non-knowledge is the first of all, in all caps again, anguish. In anguish appears nudity, which leads to ecstasy. But ecstasy itself, nudity, communication, slips away if anguish slips away. Thus, ecstasy only remains possible in the anguish of ecstasy, in the fact that it cannot be satisfaction, grasped knowledge. Evidently, ecstasy is, first of all, grasped knowledge, in particular, in the extreme destitution and the extreme construction of that destitution that myself, my life, and my written work represent. This I know, no one has taken knowledge as far. No one has been able to, but for me, it was easy, obligatory. I'll just stop there a moment. I have in my notes, non-knowledge is the ongoing destituent power operation on absolute knowledge or the pursuit of knowledge as a kind of existential satisfaction, insofar as knowledge is able to provide existential certainties. And so at this point, we have the defendant, Adam, on the stand.
Well, no, I mean, that's literally my PhD thesis. I don't. The idea that, I mean, to do a destituent power operation on absolute knowledge means to not to simply negate the system, but to liberate it from its own internal economy by which, you know, you keep going between these fixed positions of, you know, oh, look, you're caught in self-consciousness, you're caught in consciousness, you're caught in this form of spirit, you're caught in that form of spirit. It's about the idea that if you understand the underlying logic of the internal economy of the system, then maybe you can find its limit and find the points at which you can sort of render these systems, these economies, more malleable in the way you can creatively redeploy them for your own ends. To open up new possibilities from a system like the system of German idealism, you know, from the system of Hegel in this case, that is the destituent power operation, the idea of liberating the potential energy that the system relies upon from its bonds within its own internal discourses and its own internal logic. And fundamentally, that's my project. It's also Bataille's project. I do it with Stirner. He does it with, well, himself. I mean, fair enough. And ultimately, if you get this idea of releasing the potential energy which this system sort of captures, this is where you come back to the idea of expenditure. Because everything, you know, just to quote that great philosopher Nintendo, everything not saved will be lost. You know, the discourse always saves meaning and uses it and spends it somewhere else. But if you get into the idea of losing yourself, you know, getting out of yourself is what ecstasy means, ecstasis, then you get this economy of loss, which is able to simply let things go and to enjoy itself and experience that raw expenditure of vitality, expenditure of life, which is, in any way, given that eventually all life will be expended and will be dead. And this is something you can see if patrons for the self-enjoyment talk I did with Stirner on the Patreon, but it's about entering into this economy which you don't have to preserve everything. Bataille looks at Hegel in the same way that Foucault looks at Hegel, which is quite funny given that Foucault was learning it from Hippolyte and Bataille from Kojève, as this kind of omnipresent figure who is just devouring everything. You can never escape him. He'll just show up, and like Saturn devouring his child, he will eat you and you will never escape his grasp. This is an economy of loss. I mean, what Bataille is doing is he's taking really the idea that Hegel will preserve everything. Everything is preserved in spirit. Spirit is eternal. Nothing is ever lost. I don't think he's right on that. But at the time, he's going on a really one-sided reading of Hegel, which produces a Hegelian counterpart in non-knowledge, in loss, in expenditure.
I mean, here's a question I would pose, and this I'm totally riffing here, didn't plan to do this, but let's transpose the form of this argument to that which is relevant to today's politics, I guess, or at least to political praxis. Because when we think of destituent power in today's political milieu, what does it mean? Can we transpose the term destituent power operation on absolute knowledge to destituent power as it operates on current hegemony, the state, capitalism, what have you. And now we also have the term satisfaction, anguish, and ecstasy. What are their analogs in the political field? And is it possible to have, to simultaneously experience anguish, a sort of tension of intensities coming from the outside, that which the system will not permit to let in, while maintaining a sense of satisfaction that, like when I think of the state, for example, it privileges a set of political intensities and excludes others. It engenders an attempt to be self-satisfied in its own way. I mean, how does it resolve the notion that there is this outside which pushes on the edges while remaining self-satisfied? To me, I can't seem to square those things. So when I take that and I throw it back onto the problem that Bataille is posing here, I find it hard to square that kind of Hegelianism. But like, I'm not saying it's impossible. The question is, how do you do it between those two problems?
I can't believe you didn't listen to the last episode, Craig. I mean, we gave the solution in the last episode. It's it's jungle music. I'm serious. I mean, Fisher talks about, he cites Kojo Eshin's formulation of jungle as the libidinalization of anxiety. And I like that idea. It's, in terms of the transgressive insurgent point for political action, if you can libidinalize the anxiety of that, where you're not certain whether you're going to be successful, but you enjoy it anyway. You enjoy the very active insurgency for the promises it gives, even though these promises have no potential for salvation in themselves by necessity. I think the libidinalization of anxiety is definitely a point at which you can communicate this idea of ecstasy. Again, ecstasy, what is ecstasy other than getting out of yourself into something and into another? Ecstasy itself has a kind of communication.
Well, to be sure, I don't think ecstasy and satisfaction are the same things. Think about how we talked about salvation so far. I mean, if we accept that salvation is the derision and destitution of desire itself, I think it precludes the kind of ecstasy that you're arguing for.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm not sure. Though,
I mean, maybe we could talk about the God stuff somewhat, because for Bataille's model, the model is completely absent of salvation and satisfaction. And then maybe in that sense, we can have a bit of a Marcello Tari thing here. Check our episode on Tari, about the idea that we have to act as if our own identities are going to be completely lost in the insurgent or revolutionary action.
Adam, do you have those paragraphs? Maybe you can read
them.
Yeah,
I can read that one.
And sorry, my cat has arrived, so we'll hear my cat in the episode.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to apologize for my reading, my pronunciation of Biblical Aramaic, I believe. The imitation of Jesus. According to St. John of the Cross, we must imitate in God, Jesus, the fall from grace, the agony, the moment of non-knowledge of the Lama Sabachthani, which is Aramaic for Father, why have you forsaken me? Drunk to the lees, Christianity is absence of salvation, the despair of God. It fails in that it attains its goals out of breath. The agony of God in the person of man is fatal. It is the abyss into which vertigo tempted him to fall. In the agony of a God, the confession of sin is irrelevant. This agony justifies not only heaven, the dark incandescence of the heart, but hell, childish, flowers, Aphrodite, and laughter. Well, okay. In the agony of God, there is no longer any confession, which shows to me that it is an inner experience of the kind he's trying to bring us into sort of consciousness of in the first chapter, where he talks about, you know, not being in a mode of confession.
No, that's fine. You know, I want to understand to what extent the idea of kenosis is operative here. And For anybody who listened to the last episode of Inner Experience, we talked about James Hillman. I was recently listening to a lecture series by James Hillman called The Politics of Feeling. And I mean, Adam talks about the concept of kenosis quite a bit in his writing. And I was very surprised to see that Hillman himself had his own theory of kenosis, which connected to political action. And I would say insofar as I have affinities with Christianity, it's probably only in this sense. And I like the way that Hillman developed it. And here's my understanding of it. And hopefully I can square it with Adam before moving forward to see if it works in our discussion, which is that when Jesus came to earth, one of the conditions of his arriving on earth was that he was deprived of his divine status. He was emptied out. And it was only at the end of his life, when he was put upon the cross, there he was as God-man, divested of his powers of the divine, and at the same time had lost that sense of immediacy or connection with God, thus said, "Why have you forsaken me?" And it was in this moment of utter vulnerability, not only the image of Christ, but those around him, the Roman soldiers, the people crying, the suffering that was taking place on that tableau was experienced with such a utterly raw, visceral kind of sense. And to me, that looks very different from versions of salvation that, you know, you get just going to church here in the United States. All you have to do is say, you know, is Lord Jesus, your savior? Yes or no? Yes, good. Okay, you're in. And it's like, now let's get your Bible. Let's go to the seminars. We're going to go to the youth group and this sort of thing. Where often the experience of salvation, you know, and this isn't for all Christians, but I'm sure some Christians would say this is true for people in their congregation. They undergo the incorporeal transformation as the saved one. But instead of it operating as a kind of emptying or release or a sort of destruction of the epistemological grounds, if you will, it more occurs as an anchor, where their salvation means that this is something that they can cling to as they pursue the gospel of prosperity or something else, right? And so I see that as being radically different. And I'm wondering if your reading of Bataille vis-a-vis Hegel incorporates that notion of kenosis.
Kenosis is ultimately just the idea of self-giving. And I'm quite interested that Hillman thinks that the kenosis part is the emptying of Jesus's divinity. That's quite interesting. I always think of kenosis as sort of, you know, in the manner of, you know, spirit falling into time, but applied to God. You know, God kenoticizes himself into a human vessel and then dies. And I think there's a lot of linkage you can get between contemporary Hegelian readings of Christianity, particularly like atheist Christians like Zizek, and what Bataille is doing here. Because the idea of God entering into agony, God entering sort of into the human form and showing it to its limits in this incredibly painful experience of torture, and then essentially exiting his own divine economy at the same time that he founds it. God dies on the cross, and it's almost like for Bataille, and this is definitely how, I mean, this is also my own theological sort of interest as well, is the idea that essentially, upon dying on the cross, God retrospectively writes himself out of existence.
Yeah.
And this is why this book is part one of a summa a theologica. It's about the traces of God in God's absence. And I think here, if inner experience entering the position of God, divine position, it's the position of total loss of oneself. It's the experience of ecstasy, both in a sense which is both kenotic, in that you give yourself this experience, you don't turn away back into the experience of the economy and try to rationalize it, but you also ecstatically, as in a sense of, you know, not only self-giving but ecstatically as self-losing or othering or getting out of oneself. In that sense, the ecstasis and kenosis are a repetition of God's self-made own death and self-made annihilation from the position of the individual subject, which is found everywhere in experience, because experience is itself contradictory. And what's more contradictory than the absolute God itself coming down to earth and then getting nailed to a bit of wood? It's the ultimate contradiction possible.
Right. Yeah.
And you can only laugh.
And that's, for me, like I said, my affinity with anything Christian is pegged to that image where you have this utterly helpless, eviscerated God-man emptied of their divinity and surrounding them once again, is this tableau, the Roman soldier gouging him with the spear, crying virgins off to the side, and, you know, who knows, dogs barking, basically, you know, almost like a Hieronymus Bosch painting of suffering, right? It's the ultimate experience of suffering, of him. Did any of you guys see The Green Knight?
I have not seen it yet, no.
First of all, I think it's excellent. I think it's excellent. I don't want to give anything away, but I'll say that there's a moment in that film in which a certain tether is alleviated, and there's the same kind of resolution that I think Adam's Christianity would really vibe with here. It's not that we don't strut on planet Earth with divine anchors that ensure our salvation. In fact, what's required in the end is a complete giving up, an emptying of that power in order to experience it in its utter immediacy, which I think is pretty beautiful. I mean, I have some problems with it, but I want to give it its moment here on the podcast. I don't want to launch the full critique, but definitely worth seeing the film too.
God loves us, so he killed himself, so we don't have to deal with the bastard anymore.
So we're coming up on the hour. Is there anything else that we need to cover? Well, maybe just takeaways from the book or other things that we didn't look at. Will, do you want to say anything?
To speak and to joke is to evade existence. That'll be my big takeaway.
We didn't get into talking about harmony and childishness, but I think for any lovers of Nietzsche, the very end of this essay, I think, is really important to understanding the full scope and contours of Bataille's ethics here. And I'm sure there's probably another hour that we could devote to this, but it's also in other areas of Bataille's work. I mean, you could pick up The Sacred Conspiracy, you could look at, you know, Klosowski's essay or, you know, Kaiwa, or, and, you know, and see fragments of this. And so you don't have to limit yourself to reading torture, which is not torturous. I mean, I love reading Bataille's work, and I don't like the idea that philosophy should be reducible to this sort of traditional exposition. I love having it embedded within this poetic or diaristic approach to things, because I think it conveys to us the sort of affect that's motivating his logic.
I mean, it's definitely, you can always see it's in the position of a tortured deity confronting its own non-existence. You know, but I think in terms of, if we want to just quickly go over the childishness stuff, people interested in childishness can also see this in the Notion of Expenditure episode. Essentially, the function of childishness is, even though childishness is essentially the economy of meaninglessness of inner experience, because it's what engenders the economy of meaning, utility, discourse, adultness, seriousness. And yet at the same time, that which it engenders, you know, the child begets the adult in development. The adult always looks back on the child as its negative, as that thing which is not sensible enough to know, as non-knowledge. It points back to it at the same time as this economy of non-knowledge is actually what engenders its economy of knowledge. I think the affirmation of childishness and of laughter and of joviality in this sense is Bataille's attempt to, not simply to return, but to acknowledge the other side of human experience. And this isn't, I think, given this critique of things as one-sided, it has a distinctly Hegelian flavor, of course, but childishness is really non-knowledge as affirmed as another aspect of human life, which we should not disavow if we want to have a complete sense of what it means to be alive.
Yeah, I think the part that really stood out to me there was the idea that what we know about childishness comes through the adult. Essentially, the knowledge of being a child is adultified, right? It comes through the adult filter, and which is perhaps even at odds with being a child. So this is an instance where a knowledge about being a child, about childishness, could even oppose the limit experience of being a child, if we want to call it that. In context of our conversation, there's a way in which we could even interpret being an adult as a kind of salvation from being a child, which, if you think about it, I mean, I'm just kind of riffing here, but think about the ways in which we can look back on childhood nostalgically, and we can, you know, deride, denigrate, you know, that experience, like, oh, that was then and this is now, and this is the more noble position to be in as an adult, and everybody has to go through that, and everybody grows up. In some ways, it creates this hierarchy of adult over child.
always try to prevent child. It always try to prevent the expenditure of childhood, which is always necessary for growth, but it's always regrettable retrospectively. As
that's always, exactly
we,
it.
We could have been working. We could have been down in the acid mines. Yeah. You've never had it so good. I wish I was a child again, but I can't. I have to go to work, sort of thing.
Yeah, if I could do it all over again, I wouldn't have done any of the things that made me who I am today and that allow me to carry on with this miserable, regrettable existence. Will, what did you have on childishness?
Childishness to me constitutes like the relationship between... It's a very particular form of regret that is accessed particularly through like the denigration and laughter at the child. Mm-hmm. Once like childishness childishness in its sort of imminence is lost the second it can be identified, right? The second we can articulate childishness as some sort of circumscribable phenomenon within like the progression of human existence, that is the precisely the moment when it is lost, and that radical Nietzschean innocence is lost. And I think the figure of the child is like really important to Bataille, to any like Nietzschean worth their salt. And to me, whenever I see the notion of the child, I'm reminded of what is at the end of that also important three metamorphoses, right? It is this rebirth of a never accessed innocence. So I think in a lot of ways, a lot of the tendencies in thinkers like Nietzsche, Bataille can actually be accessed through the way in which they talk about this notion of childishness, childhood, wondrousness, things like that.